I'm Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. The year is 1959. The album is An Evening Wasted with Tom Lehrer, the artist. Of course, Tom Lehrer, and my guest is J. Keith Van Stratton. Thank you for being here.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
How long ago did you first hear this album? I'm curious.
It must have been, well, I first heard some of the songs on Dr. Demento in the 80s. So I'm trying to think when I would have listened to that. Because what I associate this a lot with is my friendship with Fred Snyder in middle school, which I'm dating myself, obviously, would have been 82-ish, 83. So I'm sure it was around there.
Okay.
That's when I first heard it.
So, and where'd you grow up again?
Chicago.
Chicago, right. Because I did not, this is one thing I didn't get in upstate New York. We didn't have Dr. Demento. I didn't discover him until later.
My condolences.
Right? So did you have him just growing up?
Yeah, he was on the loop, FM, I think, 98 in Chicago.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know how I heard of it. I'm assuming just from some other kid or whatnot.
Yeah.
And yeah, I would stay up late. Because I think it aired Sundays, I think at 10 o'clock, 10 p.m. in Chicago. And I would stay up late, and eventually I got this this tape recorder device. It was the first thing like I ever bought with my own money. And it was like a combo tape recorder and radio. Mm-hmm. And so I could actually record the radio on it instead of just like holding it up to a radio, which I'd been doing before.
Sure.
So it came in really nice. So I would record it. I would record it every week, and it got to the point where he replayed a lot of the songs.
Sure.
So I got to the point where I was just doing sort of just the highlights.
Like, okay.
If I would start recording, if I heard a song I knew, I would just rewind, you know, I already had, I would rewind it and then record the rest of it. So that's how I got a lot of stuff. So somewhere in my garage are tapes of, like, you know, if there's an archivist out there who wants to know what the Funny Five was in, you know, 1982, I got you covered.
That's amazing. Have you ever been to Record Surplus in Santa Monica?
Yes, not for a while, but yeah, I have.
It's a great shop. Every once in a while, you'll run into an LP version of entire runs from Dr.
Oh, Demento. Really?
Yes.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and every time I've gone to his archivist, I've said, hey, do you have... He's like, yeah, no, I have it. He has them all.
I remember I had a cousin who worked at The Loop. I think she sold airtime there.
Uh-huh.
And when I found out she worked at The Loop and I somehow missed the Funny 25 one year, I hounded her. I would never talk... I would only see her at, you know, just like family events or whatnot.
Uh-huh.
When I found out she worked there, I got her phone number and I would hound her for weeks, if not months, for her to finally get me a tape of it. Because, again, there was no, you know, they didn't have internet. I didn't know anyone else who would have this. And I figured I have an Ian. I know somebody who works at the radio station, even though it was just syndicated there. So I finally, like, you know, after months, got the tape and got to listen to the whole Funny 25 of that year.
Which, that's again, amazing.
For some reason, I probably still have in my garage.
Of course.
Yeah.
Holy crap. There's something about that... That box of tapes that it's like, it would be a shame to let it go, but I also understand if you never looked at
but
it again.
But man, the time, I mean, when the last time I think I kind of audited it and threw a bunch of them out and whatnot, just like, I was so struck by just the time that I put in, you know, how much I cared about it and how, like, the concentration, like, I don't think I would have enough concentration or attention span now to, like, sit down for a couple hours and, like, listen to everything and write down the track of each thing and what the time code was and all that. I mean, I'm sure a lot of, you know, nerd culture folks can relate to this.
Sure.
You know, when you get obsessed with something like that, you know, how much time and care that you put into it.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know, maybe it's just a function of not having as much time as a grown-up. Like, I can't think of anything I put that much attention and detail in these days.
So. I know. That's one of those things you miss. And I don't know if it's a function of being a specific age or a function of being the age we were at a specific time.
Yeah.
Again, without the internet.
There's nothing else to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Like, yeah, if you found one thing that you could enjoy, you would latch onto it so much because you don't know when you would experience it again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even a TV show you love, you have to wait a whole week to see another one. These kids today, they don't understand.
Mm-mm. Can you peg what appealed about Tom Lehrer immediately to you?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about it, but I would guess that, well, first of all, just that I found it funny.
Sure.
I mean, that's, you know, and it sounded so unlike anything else that I had heard, and I didn't I think I intuitively understood that it was smart. Like, I'd heard a lot of things on Dr. Demento that were funny, but they were also dumb and silly and, you know, had fart noises or, you know, whatever else. And, like, I think I just, I think it just tickled that part of my brain that, like, oh, I recognize that because I was educated about a particular topic. Like,
I think
maybe that was one of the first times where, like, because I was, you know, listening to this record again over the last couple of weeks, you know, I was really struck by how you really had to be smart in order to get this stuff, or at least educated.
Sure.
There were so many references that would be completely lost if you didn't know, you know, what he was talking about. So maybe it was the first inkling of that.
Okay.
Also, those that having been said, listening to it now, there's at least half of the stuff that there's no way I would have understood as a kid.
I'm thinking the same thing. Yeah.
And it's so interesting that, like, how much I enjoyed it anyway, which I think just goes to, you know, there's a certain pleasure of, like, a really good rhyme or a really good bad rhyme.
Sure.
I think you know, it was the kind of thing also that I imagined, oh, this is what grown-ups think are
absolutely
is funny.
Yeah.
And so I think there was some feeling of, like, you know, I was getting in on the, you know, on something that, you know, maybe I wasn't supposed to yet. I mean,
right.
Not like finding a Playboy necessarily, but, you know, but something that was, like, a little bit, you know, I appreciate this and the other kids don't.
Of course.
You know, except for Fred Snyder, of course.
Sure. I also love that. So yeah, at the time Dr. Demento's putting this stuff out, like, it's, well, in time you're listening to it, some of this is 30 years old in terms of, like, when it was written.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And there's no way I understood, because not as much from this, but, like, from the That Was the Year That Was record. You know, there's so many things that had already happened that, like, there's no way I understood, you know, who Helen Gahagan was, or you know, whatever other references.
Or Werner von Braun, even though I guess he explains who Werner von Braun is, but still.
Yeah.
Is there, I feel like the Elements one might have been the first one I ever heard as a kid, if only because that's the easiest to latch onto.
I think maybe Poisoning Pigeons in the Park is kind of, for a kid, is like, it's so naughty and crazy.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's like, I know he's kidding, but also it's like, he's talking about killing things. Oh my God, that's so, you know, that's so crazy and gross. And he's a grown up and he knows better. You know, so I think there's something about that. And then, around that time, I guess in middle school, I'm learning what the Elements are and, you know, and like the idea that, like, wait a minute, some of them rhyme and you can sing all of them at once. Like, I didn't know what the Gilbert and Sullivan song was. I just thought it was a neat tune.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was, and then Masochism Tango was, like, life changing for me. You know, like, again, I didn't know, I think I had a tiny intellectual comprehension of what masochism meant, but certainly not in, like, the sexual context or anything like that. But I just the idea of, I think I just loved how shocking it was, and yet also, I think maybe comedically it was the first time I understood that, like, oh, you can be shocking and gross and weird and still be liked.
Right.
I think that maybe was different.
Mm-hmm. There's one moment on this entire album, I didn't write it down, but what's interesting to me is he gets a hiss for a very bad pun at one point.
A
solid hiss.
Yeah.
But a bad pun. That's the thing that turns him off.
But then a moment later, gets an applause break for something else. It was it was from, can you remember what it was?
I wrote it down. Yes. Oh, it's it's the bit about Mexico, I think, because he's talking about the inventor of the gallbladder, Dr. Samuel Gall.
Right.
And something about gargling
in the oral tradition.
It's like, you don't get a hiss anymore now anyway. So hearing a hiss is weird, but at a dumb pun.
And I'm trying to remember what, because I remember noting it when I was listening to it again recently, like just like less than 30 seconds later, he gets an applause break for something else.
And I didn't write that part down. The hiss was what threw me.
But but I think also what struck me was that, like, what was his way of singing comedically. Like, I'd never heard, and I think that's something that maybe is still a little underappreciated about him, was because, like, I didn't know, like, you know, Rex Harrison doing patter songs that were speaking. So, like, the idea that, like, you could be musically correct but alter your phrasing in order to get the joke out was also a big light bulb for me. And then as I went on to do musical theater, that's definitely something I stole from Lair.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that you could, you know, really, like, lean into a, you know, I should have taken notes also because I could have given you more specific examples. But there were, you know, times where it's like, I'm not remembering that now. I'm sorry. Maybe something will come to me. But also just, like, where the pauses were and what it meant. And, you know, until one day they caught him at it for animal husbandry kind of a thing. It's just how, like, I started to get a real delight pretty early on in, like, and similar to how a lot of times when I would listen to George Carlin of that era, just realizing that, like, you could say something in an exaggerated way, then that there was music to comedy as well.
Yeah.
I think maybe that was the first time I kind of understood that. You know, like there was in one of George Carlin's bits, he did something about truly a moment they'll never forget. And he did it like he did it in that kind of a cadence that's like, well, that's not how a person who was telling the story, like that's not how a person who was talking would say.
Yeah.
But he's doing it because he needs people to slow down here in order to land that extra joke. And
And
I think Lair did a lot of that in a way that also kind of, you know, stirred something in me and made me understand things about comedy as well.
Yeah. I have to imagine as a mathematician, I wonder if there was any study to it for him or if it was nature.
That's interesting.
You know?
Well, I know it was deliberate. So jumping ahead a little bit, I got to interview him later when I was 18.
You must have been one of the last people who got to do that. He doesn't do it anymore.
Maybe.
I called him once and he's you know I don't do interviews.
Oh, like, really?
I do know that. I was just hoping you'd forget.
It was great. So yeah, I was diehard fan, and my first year at college, I had a musicology class, and our assignment for the end of the year, we had to write a paper on any composer we could think of.
Amazing.
And the first person I thought of course was like, I want to talk to Tom Lehrer.
Of course.
And again, like I don't know where I got this gumption. It's like I never interviewed anyone. I never met a celebrity. I lived in Chicago. You meet Jonathan Brandmeier if you're lucky. So I had heard, I think, you know, just this will also date me, but, you know, again, being bored and not having internet and being into things that I love, sometimes I would just go to the library and just look up articles about him. And so I probably still have it in a file cabinet somewhere. I have just like a file of like, you know, printed out microfilm and microfiche.
Amazing.
You know, articles of, you know, little blurbs of him in Time Magazine or, you know, local reviews when he would do stuff. One of the things that I'd remember finding out was that, you know, he split his time between Santa Cruz and Cambridge. I think he might have still been teaching at Harvard then. And so I wrote him, I think I just wrote a letter. I think maybe I called Harvard and asked, like, what's the mailing address to send something to Tom Lehrer, and I found it.
Sure.
And so I sent him a nice letter saying, you know, I mean, it was a little over the top, but it was sincere. It's like, my heart is beating really fast right now as I write to you because you're, because I like you so much and blah, blah, blah. And then I explained, I'm in this music class my freshman year and, you know, I live in Los Angeles. So during the Christmas break, I'll be in California and I'd be happy to drive up to Santa Cruz to interview you if you have time, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, either way, thank you for being such an influence on me, blah, blah, blah. And then when I got back home to LA for the start of winter break, there was a letter with a return label from Tom Lehrer, and he sent this very nice, you know, nice note that said, you know, oh, thank you for the nice, you know, thank you for the kind words and blah, 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 and I'd be glad to, you know, I'll be in Santa Cruz at this time, and here's my phone number if you want to, you know, set it up, this thing. And then the last line was, or you could always change your topic to Mozart. I thought was so perfect. So I have that. I need to get that framed.
I was really gonna say, I'm glad you still have it.
I definitely do. And then so I drove up. I was on New Year's Eve, 1989, and I drove up in my Pontiac Sunbird with my friend Robin, and went to his apartment and sat there. With the exact same tape recorder that I had taped him, you know, on the Dr. Demento shows way back, and talked to him for like 2 or 3 hours.
Amazing.
And I had written all these note cards that I hadn't quite organized, so I would skip around a lot with his career, and just talked to him. He was very gracious. Mm-hmm. And at some point he was like, "Well, I've got some papers to grade," and it's like I knew enough of social cue to do that.
Yeah.
So drove back down, and then over the winter break, typed it up, and he had so much great stuff to say, and you know, he spoke. He wasn't. I wouldn't say he was like, you know, overly loquacious or anything, but you know, he tended to speak in paragraphs, I realized, and so I ended up for my paper just transcribing his side of the interview. So I took out all my questions and just kind of arranged it in different ways, and it ended up being, I think, like 20 plus pages or something like that.
All right.
And submitted that as my paper.
Holy shit.
It was one of the highlights of my life. I mean, it was even though I was nervous and you know and disorganized and all that, just to, you know, and maybe a little out of body. I think I was a little out of body. I was like so nervous that, you know, I wasn't entirely present.
Of course, of course.
But it was terrific, and got a lot of insights as well. And then that was my freshman year in college, and then my senior year in college, I directed a production of Tomfoolery, which was also great because I had all this knowledge of, you know, the stuff he had said, and I'd studied the music so well. So that was a lot of fun as well.
Holy crap. Does the tape still exist? The tapes, I would imagine.
probably in that same garage. Yeah, they probably do, actually. I hadn't thought about that.
Those should be digitized.
I tried to find it. I tried to find a digital version of the paper of the interview. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find that. I mean, that would have been on, like, you know, what was before WordPerfect? Like, it was like some, whatever the most basic word processor was, you know, mm-hmm. over like several little floppy disks from the 80s. But yeah, the tapes, I probably do have that somewhere. And then I have a printed version of the paper, I think, in the garage as well.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, if there's an archivist out there who wants this stuff, I'm certain there is. Happy to look it up.
I'll ask around.
Okay, great.
I absolutely know the person to ask.
Oh, great. No, it was good, and he gave a lot of, you know, again, what was nice is because I could really do a deep dive, because mm-hmm. you know, I could ask about specific lyrics and specific laughs. Oh, all this to say, when you were talking about, you know, was it mathematical or did he study?
Yes.
You know, where to put pauses and all that. He talked about how if it wasn't necessarily scientifically studied, he definitely, it was deliberate in terms of he knew what worked. He talked about mm-hmm. how when they first did Tomfoolery and Cameron McIntosh, if was the producer, if not, he might have been the director of the first production, and Cameron McIntosh has gone on to do pretty much, you know, all these the huge glitzy Broadway shows, all the
mm-hmm.
Andrew Lloyd Webber stuff. And he talked about that he invited him to a rehearsal, and he was sitting there watching, I think it was Jonathan Hodari was the actor doing one of the songs, and that, you know, and that Lehrer was thinking, ah, no, he's got to put the, it's the line about, there's a lot of people, I think it's introducing in National Brotherhood Week, there's a lot of people who do blah, 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 and I hate people like that, is whatever it is, mm-hmm. the joke. And that Hadari apparently was just sort of running through the line, you know, was saying like, blah, 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 and I hate people like that. And that Lyra was sitting there thinking, no, you got to put the pause there,
mm-hmm.
like, blah, and I hate people like that. And he was biting his tongue and wondering to say anything. And then Cameron McIntosh leaped up on stage and said, no, Jonathan, you've got to put the poles there, because the rest of the show. And Lair's thinking, no wonder he's the genius.
That's so amazing.
He definitely was very aware of his, you know, as a mathematician, I think you have to be. You're aware of your own technique.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess as a, you know, if you're a successful comedian, you know, you know, you say one thing one way and it works, and one thing another it doesn't. So, you know, that's your A-B testing right there.
Yeah. I feel like, too, if you can get too deep on this kind of analysis, but I think there's something to be said for recognizing the math in something rather than planning the math in something. You know what I mean? It's because it's not like I'm going to sit here and write this with an actual thing in mind, but I've just written this. Oh, here's why this works. And like recognizing patterns and algorithms, and you become a better writer, too.
Yeah,
you know, you become a better actor. Algorithms are in there, even if you can't plot them out on paper.
Yes.
You know,
and that we're all in the Matrix.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And his are just, I don't know, there's something very, they're very precise.
Yeah.
He's very precise sounding because of his incredibly,
his music, his piano playing is very precise.
Of course, yeah.
It's great to see. And I think, you know, it's funny, we're talking about rhymes. One of the things I reappreciated listening to this again recently was that, you know, because I always knew that his rhymes were tight and solid and everything worked. And he and I talked about that when I'd interviewed him about, because it wasn't, you know, he knew that it wasn't just enough, you know, when he would go into the long runs of rhymes, like, you know, like in Poisoning Pigeons in the Park, there's a small version of, like, you know, this lack of impropriety and quite a variety of pleasant names, you know, but it's like propriety, variety, you know, all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew that it wasn't just enough that it had to rhyme exactly, but it all had to make sense.
Yes.
I think it's in I Hold Your Hand in Mine when he goes, you know, he has that long run of like, lack of virility, virility will lead to hostility and a sense of identity.
Oh, yes.
And in all probability, I'll lean in. Again, I haven't listened to it in a while, so I'm paraphrasing.
Uh-huh.
But he said like how important that was to him, you know, I think as a mathematician that it made sense also.
Mm-hmm.
And I can appreciate that, you know, if you're doing, you know, something simple as geometric proofs and then you're writing lyrics, you know, I can definitely see the parallel.
Mm-hmm. And it's nice that we can appreciate that as artists, but I feel like some of that stuff's out the window when you're an artist too, because you become maybe a little, not that he's not an artist, but he's got this other, because you're an actor.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and a host. Mm-hmm. And you're not a mathematician by trade. Right. It's not a thing that you've got, but you can appreciate it at the same time.
You appreciate craftsmanship and you appreciate, you know, there's it's funny because I've said a lot of times of all the different things I do, one of the things I do love is writing lyrics, and mm-hmm. one of the things I like about it is the puzzle is figuring out, you know, how can you communicate what you need to communicate that rhymes in that compact. I mean, it is like writing a crossword puzzle or solving a crossword puzzle. So I think there is some crossover there. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think like with a lot of good art, like it it holds up when you analyze it, and it holds up when you don't analyze it. Mm-hmm. It holds up when you just feel it. I mean, none of this would matter. It wouldn't matter how good the rhymes were if it weren't funny. Or it wouldn't matter how good the rhymes were if it didn't, you know, if it didn't fit into the melody.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's great that he checks all the boxes mm-hmm. as well.
You mentioned that, so the album that you have is your own copy, but you did say there was one in the house growing up?
Yeah, well, that was what was so interesting because, you know, I think I mentioned that, you know, part of what was fun about Tom Lehrer and especially sharing it with a good friend of mine was that, like, oh my God, look what we discovered. You know, of course, we discovered it 30 years after
sure,
it came out.
Sure.
But you know, certainly, like, it was not, you know, playing on the boom boxes in the halls of our middle school.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so crazy because one time I was going through my dad's record collection and he had That Was the Year That Was. And then I was looking at my grandmother's records and she had it. So it was like, that's also kind of part of the fun journey was to realize that, you know, and also a little confusing, but also I think of probably a common experience as a kid. It's like, wait a minute, I thought I was the only one who knew this and then other people knew this also. You know, when you find out that, like, you know, a teacher knows what, you know, knows the word shit or penis or uh-huh, something, it's uh-huh. like, wait, you know that? Like, that was our thing. But yeah, so my dad definitely had That Was the Year That Was, and he may have had an Evening Wasted. But my grandmother definitely had That Was the Year That Was, and I don't remember exactly what the story was, or if it was, you know, this was also, they were part of a culture that would, you know, have people over for a dinner party or cocktail party and play a comedy.
Sure.
And I think, you know, that I wouldn't be surprised if that was, especially for my grandmother, if that was, you know, sort of what came about.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a great sense of humor. And, you know, I remember I would sometimes sing one of his songs to her, you know, to her and one of her friends and,
mm-hmm.
You know, Tom Lehrer is perfect because, like, it's naughty. It's a little naughty, but uh-huh. it's not, you know, you can still be precocious singing yes. Tom Lehrer and not, you know, have to have a conversation after unless you grew up, like, in a religious household or something and you're doing Vatican Rag.
But. Right. How common were comedy albums in general in the house then, growing up?
For me, very, because yep. I was really not into music. Even through, like, high school, I was into comedy. And so for me, you know, I would go to Rose Records or I can't remember the other record store there's in our neighborhood, and you know, and just flip through all the comedy stuff. And so when I, you know, so listening to Dr. Demento was the perfect, you know, it could not have been more perfect for me to introduce me to that world. And so, you know, when A Place for My Stuff came out for George Carlin, mm-hmm. you know, that I immediately went to the record store and bought that and, awesome. You know, wore it out. And then, of course, Weird Al was a life changer for me as well.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to get the other side of the story from whoever worked at, it was either Rose Records or See Here Records, one of these stores in my neighborhood in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
This will be the other side of the intellectual comedy coin. I got really into Gallagher also.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And then and I found out that Gallagher had released an album, mm-hmm. which if you know his act seems really
yeah.
weird.
Yeah.
It had to be special ordered from the record store. And again, as a kid, you get locked into something.
Yes.
It's like, and you got nothing else going on in your life. All you think about is when is this record come? When is the Gallagher record coming in? So almost every day, I would either call or visit the record store to
oh
the point where
God.
Like they would see me coming in and be like, "It's not here yet," and I would turn around and go home. And then it finally did come in, and like the workers there were so relieved that this, you know, this pesky 12-year-old isn't gonna, you know, keep bothering them. So I did have the Gallagher record.
Mm-hmm.
It's weird. The Sledgematic doesn't work as well on the record. I'm trying to think what other. My dad was into Mort Saul, and I think was actually pals with him for a little while.
Holy
in Chicago.
Shit!
So
wow.
So I think he had a Mort Saul record or two, and I'm trying to remember other comedy stuff. Not really. I mean, my family, you know, they liked comedy, but it wasn't mm-hmm. you know, they weren't into comedy, I would say.
Right.
And then like I, you know, I definitely got every Weird Al thing I could get a hand on. And the Tom Lehrer stuff, and then George Carlin. I eventually, you know, got myself a complete record collection over the years.
Mm-hmm. Growing up, how big were the comedy sections in these record stores you're going to? I'm curious.
Pretty good, I have to say. Yep. I'm blanking on the name of this. I could probably look it up. I'm blanking on the name of the record store that was closest to me.
Mm-hmm.
But they were pretty good. They had, you know, again, except Gallagher. but they, it definitely was, you know, the smaller, if not smallest part of the record store, but it was, you know, they definitely kept things current. You know, they would have mm-hmm. the new Weird Al record. They would have the new, George Carlin stuff. They would have, You know, some Richard Pryor stuff, Nichols and May, you know, older stuff. And I'm trying to remember, like, what else would have come out currently around there. You know, obviously Eddie Murphy when that came out.
Sure.
I mean, every, you know, you could get that, whatever the comparable to getting CDs at Starbucks, you know, like when Eddie Murphy came out, every magazine stand had the Eddie Murphy tape.
I bet.
But yeah, it was pretty good. And then, you know, when you find your friends who are into Comedy Records, you trade tapes, you know, it's funny. I actually got Fred Snyder for his bar mitzvah. I got him, I think, whatever the other Tom Lehrer records that neither of us had.
Mm-hmm.
I gave it to him, and as soon as he unwrapped them, I said, "Can I borrow these and tape them for you?" I was very generous.
Of course. Did you ever buy a record from Jimmy Pardo? I have to know.
I don't think so.
Damn it.
Well, I don't think he was in the city, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
I mean, it's possible.
I don't know where he worked. I can never remember the names of the shops he worked at.
From what I recall him saying, he worked in some mall in the suburbs. I didn't do that. No.
Son of a bitch. Keep hoping that'll happen. It'll be a little fun connection. That's okay. Do you have a favorite track or set or tracks on this album or ones also that worked for you later? I'm curious, like ones that maybe, oh, I get it now. I know what Oedipus is.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely Oedipus. I didn't appreciate that. I appreciated it for the rhymes and the laughs. And then when I started to learn the story, mm-hmm. but even then I didn't understand, you know, the full-on sexual part or the psychological implications.
Yeah.
I mean, Masochism Tango was like I said, life-changing, and I would like sing that at auditions, and I would sing it in, I remember there was a, I was in a chorus that was in the eighth grade, no, it would have been tenth grade chorus. We had a thing where we had to like perform a song in front of the other, you know, in front of everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did Masochism Tango and the chorus applauded and the music teacher was like, I just keep thinking, what a waste. I was like, you do not get me at all.
Hey everybody, thank you guys so much for listening. I just wanted to take a quick break in the middle of this episode. I know I normally would save this for the end. Would I? No, you know what? I don't normally break into my show. But there's just some fun stuff happening that would be of specific interest to comedy album lovers. While it's not on vinyl yet, my comedy record label, Celery Sound Records, is re-releasing Paul Dooley's 1961 album, Booked Solid. It's available now as a download. We're looking at what physical options we're going to look at down the line. But right now, you can download it. Just go to CelerySoundRecords.com, and you can buy his album again. It's from 1961. It's been restored by Taylor Jessen, who's been on the podcast before. He restored not only the album art, but the audio. It's really beautiful, and I'd like everybody to be able to see it in a bigger format at some point as well. Right now, you can go download it for it's under $10. At the website. Also, I've started a Patreon. It's been up there for a while. And if you go to patreon.com/stolendress, you know, the more I get in terms of patrons, the more I can do extra stuff. I know I was doing that comedy album a day thing for a while, and that kind of fizzled. This will motivate me to get it done. It's not just, you know, it's not just a matter of just doing that, but it's a matter of being able to set aside the time. So if you donate to that, that would super, super, super help out. Also, the network has a new podcast called the Awakened Soul Podcast. So just go to stolendress.com. The links are up there. It's a great new show. I think you'll enjoy it. It adds some new diverse voices to the network, which it desperately needed. So I think you'll enjoy that. And the only other thing to mention is go to danandjay.com. One of my other podcasts is called Dan and Jay's Comedy Hour. And my buddy and I, Dan, have been doing comedy together for 25 years now. So we have a new Silver Jubilee song, which is great, by Nick Robes of What's With You, Scooby-Doo. And we have a video coming out for that as well. And then on top of that, later this year, our next album, which will be released on vinyl. So that's going to be fun. I have not released the name of it yet, because if I mentioned it, your brain would melt because it doesn't make any sense and it would take too long to explain. That's, by the way, very good marketing. I'm going to put an album out with a title that people are going to have to do a lot of work to figure out. And then they'll have to ask me. Maybe, you know what, maybe I'll issue a compendium to go with it to explain how it was named and why it was named that. Thank you guys for checking all that stuff out. And now back to the show.
And so that one I knew really well. And then as far as ones I appreciated later, I'm trying to think, I'm looking here. Well, I mean, in Bright College Days, when he gets that applause break on Soon We'll Be Sliding Down the Razor Blade of Life, and then he says, ready? I mean, that, you know, I don't love that song, but like, just for that moment, it's worth it. You know, the the idea of being that in control of a moment and an audience is something that,
right.
you know, I got to experience, you know, a few times. And I think one time I was in a play in, geez, I think between 10th and 11th grade, a musical, and I had a funny moment where the work got like a big, like it got a big applause break. And I think I said that and I got an even huger applause break, you know, laughter break. So, you know, it definitely was influenced.
That's good.
Yeah. And then it's so fun. I mean, I have memories about almost every track. Christmas Carol, I sang at summer camp in, I guess that would have been between 7th and 8th grade. I was at summer camp and they did, there was this sort of hippie creative camp. And so they did like a Christmas in July show. Mm-hmm. And so I sang a Christmas Carol there and did his exact introduction and, you know, and the whole thing. And, you know, it's funny when I interviewed him and I first brought up that song, he's like, I want to apologize for the Kris Kringle line at the end. It's like, he knew that wasn't like a great ending. or the, you know, the reindeer don't stand underneath when they fly by.
Uh-huh.
So, that kind of stuff. So, I don't know. I would say, I say growing older, maybe I appreciated more of the, that was the week songs. That was the, you know, that was the year songs from that was the week that was. Mm-hmm. And actually, I don't know if you remember this, when would that have been? Maybe 10-ish years. Oh, no. It was when Bush was about to get reelected. So that was, what, 2004-ish?
Mm-hmm.
ABC Primetime Live did That Was the Week That Was segment at the end for mm-hmm. a little while, where they would have, at the end of their show, they would have Kevin Ruff, who's a Groundlings guy I know, would be like a news anchor, and then they would have this blonde woman sing a song, like, with some of the week's events. And I actually got to write on that a little bit.
Oh, my God.
It didn't quite work because, well, one, because they only did that was the week that was theme song, and then would just, add in new couplets and,
okay.
and lyrics.
Okay.
But it was funny. The one thing I did relate to, when he told me when that was the week that was on, and they had the singing model who did a lot of his songs originally, who I'm blanking, it's something Ames. Do you have Nancy Ames?
Oh boy, I don't know.
I'm sure it's easy to look up. But so they had this like statuesque blonde singer who sang very properly, and he would have to like come in and like tell her how to do the joke. And I think one of the reasons that he wanted to do the album of That Was the Year That was because a lot of times the jokes wouldn't come across because, okay. you know, again, you have to slow down here and pause here and speak, sing this here. And
sure.
So, you know, for this, for someone who's singing, you know, a lot of these songs don't work if you sing them properly.
Right, right.
Which is great. Like, I love that also as, like, a new way to understand music.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that's true. There's not a lot of musical comedy where you can break it down, or at least that I think of it in mm-hmm. that way, where you can break it down and, no, this has to be sung in a certain way. Or, like you say, speak singing in a certain way. God, yeah, it's more complicated, I think, than it's given
credit
for.
And I think what was also interesting is that, like, I think my understanding for a long time was that, like, oh, people who speak sing are people who can't really sing, like mm-hmm. Rex Harrison.
Or, right, right, right.
You know, but, like, no, like, because he could, you know, he sang perfectly fine and can sing on tune and obviously, you know, a lot of different styles and mm-hmm. with great precision. But he did it on purpose because, you know, that's what the joke required, or that's mm-hmm. what he needed you to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. You know, he didn't have like George Burns' cigar on stage to tell you this is where the laugh was.
Sure, sure.
So, you know, he had his you know, you talk out the last phrase mm-hmm. and people know that's where the joke is.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of stuff.
How much like Tom Lehrer did he sound when you interviewed him? I'm just curious how intact the accent remains.
Oh, that's a neat question. Again, it was so long ago. I haven't listened to that tape in a while.
Yeah.
It took a while. The thing is I don't know if I had not seen a recent photo of him before.
Mm-hmm.
So he sounded enough like himself that it took a long time of like looking at him and hearing a voice that I knew come out of someone who, you know, who I picture differently or hadn't seen. Like whenever you see someone you listen to on a radio or a podcast and mm-hmm. you find out what they look like and it doesn't quite match and there's that, you know, moment of adjustment. So he sounded enough that I understood it. And you know, when he would tell stories and kind of do, you know, do little asides, he definitely had a lot of the same timing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was definitely an adjustment.
Yeah. I'm curious if he appreciated you as an audience, or was it more conversational, or was he really trying to, I'm curious, is he your performer in conversation? Some people are.
Some of it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's not to the point where like it was phony mm-hmm. or it was
right.
Or it was annoying or he was avoiding questions or anything. Like I'm
just a good storyteller.
Doing. Yeah, no, I think he would. I think he appreciated. He took all my questions. Again, you know, I was 18. I was 18.
Yeah.
And he was
yeah.
what in his 50s? I would guess. At
I would
time,
imagine.
Or 60s?
Sure.
I don't know. Well, no, it was the 80s. Yeah, 50s or so. I mean, I definitely was entertained, but I didn't feel like, you know, he certainly wasn't like looking for a laugh or anything that. What was also interesting was that he very clearly did not want to talk anything about his personal life.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was just trying to get some basic biographical info about, you know, what, you know, about your childhood. It was like, no, just standard stuff.
Okay.
You know, like he really didn't want to talk about that.
Interesting.
He didn't want to talk about his, you know, relationships if he'd had any.
Sure,
any,
sure.
That kind of stuff. So.
All right.
Which, you know, I respected.
Absolutely. But, yeah.
You know, well, I was a little disappointed because I kind of just wanted to understand, you know, who he was and all that. But no, he also, I think what was also really cool about it was that, you know, a lot of times I've interviewed people about their work, and especially when it's so many years after they had popularity, and they're like, oh, I don't know, I don't remember. I don't,
yes.
You know, it's like a lot of times, you know, especially if you're on like, if you've written a bunch of songs or done a lot of concerts or, you know, been on a million sitcom episodes, I mean, it's like asking like, hey, remember this piece of paper you filed,
of
you know, 30
course.
Years ago?
Yeah.
But, you know, no matter how detailed I went into stuff, he knew what I was talking about, and he could, you know, he could address it. So he really knew his material well. And at the same time, was incredibly humble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I think the first line of the paper that I put in was him saying, I wasn't really that popular, you know. It's like, you know, he understood that, like, for people who, you know, who liked what they would call novelty records, that he was, you know, he was the bee's knees. But, you know, he knew that he was not, you know, there were plenty of people who had no idea who he was, and he was perfectly fine with that.
Yeah.
And that, you know, he you know, it was interesting. If he had not had his other career and a successful career and one that was also satisfying to him, I wonder kind of what would have become of him. If I wonder if he would have been as happy or as, you know, satisfied with things, because it's got to be really frustrating to have to know that you're good and to get the critical acclaim from people that matter, and to have lasted for so long, but also to have given it up.
Yep, just let it go.
Yeah, to just let it go. You know, his line was always that, you know, when Henry Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize, he realized he couldn't write funny songs anymore.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure entirely how true that was, but, you know, he also, I think, would have been incredibly happy just to be known as a great math professor who also taught classes in musical theater.
Sure. Yeah, see, that's that's what I'm curious. I everybody I've known, and I've known a ton of people who went to Santa Cruz. Mm-hmm. None of them ever had him in a class. So, yeah, so I want to know what that's like.
Well, it's funny you should mention that, because I ended up getting I do my podcast on the Maximum Fun Network, and I went to a ball game with Jesse Thorne.
Yeah,
and we were talking. Actually, I think we were talking about that I was going to be on your podcast the next day before we rescheduled, and I mentioned that I was going to talk about Tom Lehrer, and we ended up talking about Whatnot, and Jesse went to Santa Cruz, and it turned out Jesse had been in one of his classes.
Oh, that I didn't know. Okay.
Yeah, you definitely got to ask him about this, because I want to know more about it.
Mm-hmm.
But Jesse said that it was the musical theater appreciation class, or whatever it was called. And apparently he said it was Lehrer and maybe two other professors. But when Lehrer described it to me, he said pretty much he just goes up to the front of the class, puts on a record of South Pacific, and then, you know, and then they all talk about it.
Okay.
But he described that he got a lot of satisfaction out of it. He described how he would put on, it was either that show or it was another Rodgers and Hammerstein show, we would put on, and, you know, he loved seeing students cry, or, you know, students tear up, weep over, you know, over just hearing the record of a show from 50 years before.
Yeah.
And all that. And boy, did he hate Andrew Lloyd Webber. It was so great hearing him talk about how much he hated Andrew Lloyd Webber, and also hearing about it's fun. I talked about this with Jesse, because he talked about how much he loved he didn't listen to much popular music, but he loved Paul Simon, and he gushed about the line, I think it's in I Know What I Know, where he says, "Didn't I see you? Don't I know you from the cinematographer's party?" I don't know if I'm quoting it exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I mean, what a line. Who would even think of that? So hearing Tom Lehrer gush about something made me want to go back and revisit that. And every time I hear that line, I think of you know, how
course.
Much Tom, like, that must be a good line if Tom Lehrer likes it.
Of course, of course.
Yeah.
Holy shit. That's so good. Yeah, you're making, obviously, you understand that I have to hear this now.
Okay,
you realize that, right?
I
will digitize the fucking thing for you if you want.
If you remind me, I have a pretty good guess of which sector in the garage it's in. So if it's there, it is yours, and my only reluctance is just to hear what I sound
of
like.
Of course, of course.
I know. It's funny, whenever I listen to myself now, I feel like, oh my god, I say you know every time. It's like I think that's my Chicago upbringing. So it's like the fact that I can't imagine how much I even say it more than. But sure, you can, you're welcome to it.
I started this show 7 years ago, and I can't listen to my first shit. It's just, it's terrible. It's horrible to listen to. Has Tom Lehrer, has your perspective on Tom Lehrer changed over the years, or is it just something you kind of dip into for comfort every once in a while, or for a laugh?
I really don't know. I was really glad for the opportunity to revisit it that you gave me with this, because I hadn't heard it in a long time. So it definitely is comforting, and I think my perspective maybe now is more of, as a writer than a performer, although I'm still struck by the performance aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think maybe I come to it with a more of a critical eye, comedically, or even actually on this record, there's some weird edits that happen kind of abruptly where you can kind of tell, you know, the audience applause doesn't quite match up, so they cut something. So maybe more of a critical eye of like, oh, why did they put that there? Why would he leave in this long intro about the gallbladder that has nothing to do with Mexico? Where like he gets a couple great, you know, there's a couple good lines. My other favorite line from that, where he says he was a doctor specializing in diseases of the rich. Oh, I love that line.
That's a really good one.
I've tried to use that in conversation a couple times. It never goes over as well. So I think they're, you know, like I said, the main thing I was struck by when I listened to it again recently was how little of it I could possibly have understood as a teenager, as a preteen even, and yet how much I still liked it. And I think that's something that's really interesting for me, that it's sort of the same way that you know, a show that you would be watching as a kid that's now on Netflix and you revisit and you're like, what, how would I like it? But this was sort of a converse of that, because I understood how I liked it, but how is it that there was so much for me to like that I didn't understand?
Yes.
Like there was so much more I could have liked about it. And so that's just really cool that, you know, he was certainly not pandering. I mean, anything,
sure.
But, and yet a kid could still appreciate it. And maybe it was a certain kind of kid or whatnot, but I think there is something childlike about his delight, I think, that translates. I think he's delighted that he came up with these rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not braggy about it, and he's not smug about it, but I think that comes across in a way, and that's something that I really like, cuz I think artists are allowed to like what they did.
Sure.
And I think a lot of times these days you either get the detached irony of like, oh, who wrote this crap that I wrote, or the complete opposite of like, hey everybody, look at me, I'm awesome. Uh-huh. You know, uh-huh. I'm a Snapchat star. And so just the idea that you can do good work and appreciate it, and not be, you know, a dick about it, I think is really neat, and maybe something that it must be something that I'm not used to hearing, because I was really refreshed by it.
Right. I hadn't put those two together. I hadn't put the idea together, but that's a really good point, because often when we're talking about kids that age, and by the way, it's always that age. It's always like between 12 and 14.
Yeah.
It's always between 12
and
14.
Which is so weird, because these were like party records. I mean, these were supposed to be for, you know, ad executives on the weekend. You know, this was supposed to be for the Mad Men crowd.
Right.
I was really disappointed in Mad Men that he never came up.
Yeah, right? Because I know that, I haven't seen the episode yet,
yeah.
but Newhart's album obviously makes an appearance in one episode.
Yeah.
There might have been another one.
And
yes,
Newhart also is a big plot point in the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yes,
and it totally would have been around that time. So there might be season two. Maybe it'll show up there.
I know,
because that was also his scene.
Mm-hmm.
That was also so interesting, because he, you think about this guy who's a Harvard professor, suit and tie, crop cut, horn rim glasses, doing smarty pants intellectual songs, and he's playing the Hungry Eye in San Francisco, where like Dick Gregory is, and where you know, it's just so interesting that this was counterculture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. A fucking Harvard guy.
Harvard
master. Yeah, he's... I don't know. It's one of those things where, like, when people talk about being primed for pop culture or understanding culture, it's always, my parents were laughing, so I laughed. Or I heard the laughter on the record, and I laughed.
Yeah.
But what you're talking about is much more his personality and his glee with doing his own thing. It doesn't come up. I think maybe because a lot of it is stand-up, you don't really get to hear it in the same way. Mm. Maybe. I could be wrong. Although, George Carlin, I loved Carlin for some of the same reason.
But it still had the imprimatur, am I saying that correctly? Imprimatur? It was curated by Dr. Nemendo, or it was introduced by someone.
Sure.
So you definitely were primed that this is going to be something funny. It wasn't just like a random thing you know, that I happened to hear. But yeah, it'd be interesting, because I don't remember if the first stuff I heard was the stuff that was recorded with a live audience, or if I'm not mistaken, almost every song that he did for a live audience, he also had a studio version of. Mm-hmm. So it'd be interesting if, you know, I don't know if I heard it on, you know, the studio version first, but I don't know. I don't know how I would never, I can't see a scenario where I would not laugh at Masochism Tango and want to rehear it a million times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my heart is in my hand. Ugh. You know, that kind of stuff.
That's like, a solid bit.
That's just, mwah.
And also, like, in a moment of pure darkness, we'll all go together when we go, is one of my favorite things that's ever been written, mm-hmm. I think. And I'm glad we got to revisit it, because, again, I don't dig back, because I've got too many albums to dig through. Mm-hmm. When somebody makes me listen to an album, yeah, I remember how much I absolutely love that fucking song.
And I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but, you know, as much as I like that he delights in when he has got a great rhyme,
mm-hmm.
but he loves his bad rhymes, too.
Yes.
There's a great one in "And We All Go Together When We Go," that gets a applause break. Mm-hmm. "We all go to respective Valhallas to go directly. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. You know, and again, the way he leans into his bad rhymes is so great, because like a lesser lyricist. I mean, you see the still when you go see musicals,
mm-hmm.
would do that rhyme and either just, you know, think, either just not acknowledge it in terms of like, this is obviously what rhymes, or would be so proud of themselves for coming up with a good rhyme, and like, he knows that it's bad and it kind of worked and he had to manipulate it,
mm-hmm.
and like, that to me is just such a, you know, it's, I love that his two lyrical trademarks are really good, really good clever, solid 100% rhymes that, you know, repeat. And also equally terrible, punny,
mm-hmm.
you know, have to stretch out the word Harvard and Discarvard,
mm-hmm.
and like that he's equally great at both of them is so interesting.
He makes
and,
a meal
and
of
fun.
Them. It's so much fun to listen to. You talked a little bit about it, but the specific influence on your love of musical theater or your mm-hmm. performing in musical theater. What do you think? Where's the influence, if it's easy to peg down?
You know, he obviously loves musicals, mm-hmm. and so even if I didn't necessarily grow up with the same ones,
mm-hmm.
I can just hear it in my, I can, you know, I haven't done musical in a long time, but, you know, especially in college or whatnot, I could hear it in myself when I would, you know, do a funny song and take that extra pause, or, I think one of the things that I appreciated is that, you know, when he does adjust the phrasing of it, it's still musically correct, it still fits in. You know, if you'll notice, a lot of times the piano part doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I got an appreciation for, sort of in a similar way to sort of jazz or anyone else who does sort of an interesting run or phrasing, that, oh, you can make this thing your own as long as it fits in that structure. It's a mm-hmm. lot sort of like improv or I guess jazz, that, you know, as long as you agree that you're going to come back to where the meter is, or as long as you agree that you're going to say the line correctly, you know, I'm going to say the same words, but I'm gonna, you know, give it some character.
Yeah,
I think that I definitely attribute that to him, in a lot of the any performance that I do, as well as looking for when I was writing a lot more songs for myself, I could definitely hear his voice in my stuff, especially. I don't know. I didn't take music theory, so I don't know the exact phrase, exact vocabulary. But you know, when you come to the last refrain and you're doing a rhyme, but then he'll add in another line before the final rhyme that all three rhyme. Like he'll do, like I mean, like in, "It Makes a Fellow Proud to Be a Soldier." He'll do something like, "It makes a fellow proud to be what as a kid I'd vowed to be, what who something allowed to be a soldier."
Uh-huh.
Then I'm sure it's influenced from other, you know,
sure,
from other musical theater, but the thing of like throwing in an extra rhyme, an extra line to get in another rhyme at mm-hmm. the end of the song. Again, I'm sure there's a word for it, and I'm sure he didn't invent it, but I definitely realized, oh, that's something I could do, and,
of course.
And this is a word that I haven't used yet to rhyme, so I'll just put it in at the end and give myself another joke.
Yeah.
Why not? Like,
it's
that,
nice
that
being
I totally
to,
lifted from
yeah, him. To pull tools like that from people who are influences, that's kind of great.
Yeah.
Is there one, let's say a Tom Lehrer cover album was going to come out. What do you cover? What's the one
that's
your
question.
Best suited? Any album, obviously.
I haven't looked at all of the list of things, but
mm-hmm.
I love Masochism Tango, but as far as like how my voice goes, I would maybe do What was it on TV? On that was the year that was the. I mean, National Brotherhood Week is so great.
It's beautiful.
It, yeah. And unfortunately holds up and always needs updating.
Uh-huh.
When we did it in, so, you know, there's that line of Lena Horne and Sheriff Clark are dancing cheek to cheek in the book version of the show, the script.
Mm-hmm.
It says, feel free to update even encourage it or insist to update with whoever the current people were. So I think at our time it was like, I think we went more for gay instead of racial. We did.
Okay.
I think we did. I think it was like Jesse Helms and I'm blanking on his name. Who was the gay senator from Massachusetts? Barney Frank.
Oh yeah.
So I think we did Jesse Helms and Barney Frank are dancing cheek to cheek. And when I've seen the production in different places, you know, different times and places, it's interesting to see how that gets updated. And unfortunately, it will always be accurate.
Of course, of course.
So I think that would be kind of fun, and also just, you know. How do you not, especially as a Jewish person myself, to, mm-hmm. to how can you turn down the opportunity to say, and everybody hates the Jews, but uh-huh. during, you know, uh-huh. everyone, and everyone hates the Jews. again, unfortunately, probably a timeless sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So probably that one. That would be actually really, that'd be a really great project to do. Mm-hmm. Somebody out there should put that together.
Absolutely.
Because I think there are a lot of other, there are a lot of, I know there's like Broadway people who adore him,
mm-hmm.
and there's probably comedy people who can carry a tune that would be fun to do that.
We could sell the album on Who's Going to Do the Elements. If you've ever seen Daniel Radcliffe do it, he's got the thing memorized,
okay.
and let's sell it on Harry Potter's name alone.
There you go.
Holy shit, I feel like I should wipe this off the podcast and nobody gets to hear it, and this is our album.
Because I think he had a note also about updating that song, because others have been.
I think so, yeah.
I think I heard I don't know if it was Radcliffe, somebody did a version where they added, you know, at least one more stanza to,
that's
know,
great.
To bring in, I don't know what was new, California might have been since.
Oh,
that,
right, yeah, and some, maybe some new man-mades some other in ones, here and yeah. there. Yeah, that's great. Oh, I love this idea very much.
I'm in.
All right. well, that's the end of the show. Oh, well, actually, very close. Before we promote your show, which we absolutely will do, if somebody, let's say, has never heard of Tom Lehrer, or just hasn't heard this album, what's a good reason to listen to this one?
I'll just go first and foremost. I think it's funny.
Yep.
I think this is, again, I haven't compared and contrasted a lot of his other records, but I think this is a really good entry point because it's got some political-ish stuff, but also, you know, you don't need context to hear things like Masochism Tango or Poisoning Pigeons in the Park.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who knows, but, you know, that might be too politically incorrect these days. Mm-hmm. But a lot of these, you know, elements is... How can you not be impressed with that?
Agreed, yeah.
Just, you know, even if you don't know Gilbert and Sullivan, even if you don't necessarily know, even if you don't know that these are all real elements, that they all actually rhyme, that they are, you know, that
for sure.
That it holds up, it's still, I think, entertaining and an impressive feat.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can also appreciate, like, okay, not everyone's a, you know, not everyone's a winner.
Mm-hmm.
Or that, you know, that a lot of his songs, like, I don't like the Old Mexico particularly, but, like, there's some fantastic jokes in it. You know,
yeah,
the
yeah.
whole thing about, you know, the dog was run over by the car with such precision,
mm-hmm.
that they awarded him the ears, both ears and the tail, and stuff like that. Uh-huh. I definitely think to listen to it, if I had to recommend it, it would be because A, it's funny, B, it just shows great musical chops,
mm-hmm.
and also, as I'm sure millions of people out there want to have an insight into what makes J. Keith Van Stratton, this is it.
Perfect. Let's talk about your show.
Sure.
It is called Go Fact Yourself.
It is, yes. It's called Go Fact Yourself. It's a comedy trivia quiz show with celebrities. We're on the Maximum Fun Network. We come out twice a month. And the meat of the show is we have two celebrities in advance of the show tell us three topics that they feel that they know a lot about.
Mm-hmm.
We pick one of them, write a trivia quiz for them, and then bring out an actual expert in that topic to go over the answers.
Yeah.
And to let them geek out. And it's a lot of fun. We're as we're recording this, we're doing our 14th and 15th shows tomorrow, so we're still mm-hmm. pretty new. If you're in the LA area, it's free to come to our shows. We tape usually twice a month. And it's been really fun. And we've gotten some great guests. I co-hosted with Helen Hong, who a lot of people might know from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had folks like Jimmy Pardo, Pete Holmes, Fred Willard. Coming up, we've got Lorraine Newman, Tom Bergeron.
Amazing.
A bunch of great people, Maria Bamford. And it's really fun because you still get to hear your favorite people be funny and interesting, but they get to talk about something that they love, which they don't often get to do.
Right.
So they definitely get a chance to, you know, promote their podcast and books and TV shows and all that.
Sure.
But they also get to talk about, you know, Beth Littleford comes on and talks about why she knows so much about artificial sweeteners, and you know, Pete Holmes comes on and talks about Mad Men, and you know,
amazing.
We'll probably, it's funny, we haven't actually had anyone pick a comedy music record or comedy record, but I'm sure that'll come up also.
Sure.
So I'll need an expert for that. Mm-hmm. But it's fun to talk to. I love shows. I love doing shows where I can talk to celebrity types and also talk to, for lack of a better word, civilians. Mm-hmm. But civilians mm-hmm. who also know a lot about something, and then to yeah. see these people connect is amazing. And some of the moments are so fun because it's a surprise. It's a total surprise to the guest, to the celebrity guest. Not only what topic we're going to talk about, but also who the expert is. They have no idea.
Yeah. That's nuts.
So we've had some wonderful moments. The last show we just did was Jackie Cation was on,
mm-hmm.
and she said she knows a lot about Marvel Comics, and we got on Mark Waid, who's a big comic book writer,
mm-hmm.
and just to see her expression when she came on, I mean, you know, she's used to reading all of this stuff, you know, just alone in her head, and to like actually meet him and talk about it was amazing.
That's awesome.
Or we had Andrea Savage from the show I'm Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
She said she knows a lot about Little House on the Prairie because she watches it mm-hmm. on DVD every day with her 9-year-old, and I happened to be pals with the woman who played Nellie Olson. And when Alison Armgrim came on, and we said, "And here now your expert," she played Nellie Olson. I mean, it's like their souls met in space.
It was
great. So I live for those moments. So
that's phenomenal.
It's a lot of fun. So whether you know the celebrities or you just like trivia or smart people figuring things out, mm-hmm. It's a good time.
That's so good. That's amazing. Trying to think. Also, where can people find you? There we go.
Oh, sure. Well, the show you can find wherever you get podcasts, or you can go to gofactorpod.com for mm-hmm. our schedule and tickets and whatnot. And on Twitter, we're at gofactorpod, and I'm at @J_Keith, and my website, which I don't think I've updated since 2014, so mm-hmm. see what the world was like back then, is jkeith.net.
Awesome. Hey, thank you for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. It's really fun.
You're welcome to come back anytime.
I've got many, many more records I can talk
about. Good. No, this will be fun. This was a very good time. I rarely have anything good to promote. Well, that's not true. What am I doing just shitting on myself?
Hey, come on.
It's true.
I hear you do a podcast about vinyl records.
I do. That's right. Good call. Listen to this one. I do two other podcasts. You guys can listen to those. Let's see. On Twitter, I'm Jay Klamm, JKLAMM. On Instagram, I've actually been doing something on Instagram, which is Jason Klamm, hashtag the professional blur. I've been talking about all my extra work because it's fun, including Mad Men. A ton of Mad Men, actually.
Oh, there you go.
Mad Men a lot. That was the last show I ever did, actually.
You could use our expert instead of Alan Havey.
I would have been the worst expert on the planet. Holy crap. I was there for like 10 episodes. It was fun. Super fun. So I'm doing that. That's about it. Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klamm. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune into the new Stand Up channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast.